From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made, well, we don't know exactly when. It wasn't a single moment. It happened over the past 200 years or so. And it is, if you'll permit me saying so, pretty amazing. Here's the story. It's happening in Amsterdam. In an apartment building, there's a blackbird now living in a potted plant on the balcony. Okay, I know that's not exactly thrilling, but wait, consider this. Europe's blackbirds are not the same as North American blackbirds, by the way. They've had millennia of rural life, so these blackbirds sing, they're a bit skittish, they migrate. What's the big deal? Well, in cities like Amsterdam, the European blackbirds are different now. Sometime in recent decades, they started singing at a higher pitch, just high enough that you could still hear them over the heavily trafficked streets. They also developed stockier bills. They became not as skittish. They're just calm enough to live in a potted plant on a balcony. Oh, and they don't migrate as much because cities have food and warmth that they would need. All of this comes from a remarkable article in the New York Times titled, "Evolution is Happening Faster Than We Thought." These are evolutionary changes for a bird that has adapted to city living, and it might make us wonder, what does it mean to be a blackbird? Well, now let's shift that question. If evolution is happening faster than we thought in birds and mice and even spiders, then what's going on with human beings? Fast or not, it's still not easy to see evolution in process. But it's worth asking, what does it mean to be human? That's the question at the heart of a new traveling exhibit from the Smithsonian National Museum. It's being presented right now at the Tompkins County Public Library. Fascinating stuff. There are 3D skull casts, interactive kiosks, media presentations, a 1,200-square-foot display, and more. And here's something else that's interesting. Sometimes when we discuss evolution, we end up with science versus religion. In this case, the exhibit and the library want to explore how religion is very much part of what it means to be human. There's an event coming up titled From Human Origins to Human Opportunities, Science, Religion, and Culture as Essential Decision-Making Tools for Turbulent Times. Well, this hour, our monthly science roundtable explores what it means to be human, all of these subjects and more with our guests, and let me welcome them now. Dr. Warren Ullman is on the line with us. He's a director of Paleontological Research Institution, the PRI at Ithaca, and he's a professor of paleontology in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. Dr. Ullman, thanks for taking the time.
Glad to be here.
Also with us from our WEOS studios, two guests. Rabbi Suzanne Brody is there, and Rabbi Brody is Director of Education at Temple Bethel in Ithaca and participated in the Educator's Workshop for the exhibit offered by the Smithsonian. We'll have a lot to talk about, Rabbi Brody. Thank you for taking the time to join us.
Thank you for having me.
And Sally Grubb is the Exhibit Coordinator for the Tompkins County Public Library. Sally, welcome to you as well.
Thank you very much.
Well, Sally, you reached out to us initially when this was coming, and you thought this is not only a really remarkable exhibit to be coming in from the Smithsonian, but it's part of sort of a series on evolution that you guys are focusing on. Tell us a little bit about how this came together.
Well, over 2 years ago, we at Tompkins County Public Library applied to the American Library Association, with whom the Smithsonian has partnered, to host this traveling exhibit. And while we were submitting our application, we reached out to a lot of community groups for their support and their programming support as well. And as a result, we were successful in our application. And part of that discussion with the community led the library to work in partnership with the Paleontological Research Institution, the Museum of the Earth, to increase the impact of this exhibit by running programming through to the end of February. So we only have the exhibit through the end of December, but we will be installing a new exhibit, You Are Here, Exploring Human Evolution, in January. And then we will have programs that are related both in every way to the exhibits and also for Darwin Days, which take place in February. And this is just all part of the things a public library likes to do. And in a place like Ithaca, where we have so many cooperating organizations, the Museum of the Earth and the public library are both part of the Discovery Trail. And the Discovery Trail has members of the Johnson Art Museum, the ornithology lab, and I'm going to run out of names, the History Center, Cougar Nature Center, I think that's all, who join together to present joint programs or to promote each other's programs. And so that's one of the things that we will be doing. And because Ithaca has so many resources through the colleges, Cornell University, Ithaca College, and as I say, the Discovery Trail, we have an enormous number of programs that we've run for the past week and now will run through till the end of February.
And Sally, before I bring in the other guests, let me just follow up on one of the notes that I made in the introduction, which is that sometimes when evolution as a subject comes up in an exhibit, a discussion, a public debate, it can become sort of this science versus religion dichotomy. And I know Smithsonian sort of didn't want that, or at least wanted to understand beyond the science of evolution, sort of these cultural aspects and whatnot. Can you just give me a little bit of background about the importance, I think, of understanding a lot of different, I think, points of view, cultural aspects of evolution and more?
Yeah, well, one of the most important things about this exhibit is not only to bring the science out to as wide a part of the country as they can. The exhibit itself is going to 19 different libraries, public libraries, and will finish its 2-year travels in April this next year. Has been to present the science, but also to ask the question in every community, what does it mean to be human? Not just how the science works, but how it works for us as individuals. And part of the programming that we are offering and offered last week was a program specifically for leaders of different faith groups who came together, were given a tour of the exhibit by Dr. Rick Potts, who's the curator of the exhibit from the Smithsonian, and then a discussion group to see how faith and religion are not two separate entities but are inextricably intertwined. The way we feel about things is quite as important as the way we know about them scientifically. And we also had on Thursday, we had a community conversation led by Dr. Connie Burtke from the Smithsonian, who is also a Presbyterian minister, who led us, led the group in a conversation about what we think it means to be human, but also to think of it, it means to be human within the scientific context as well. When we're told that we go back so many, not hundreds of years, not thousands of years, but millions of years, 6 million years we started walking upright. That's a daunting prospect to have to consider when, if one's a Christian, one reads the Bible and hear through the creation stories that creation took place in a week. The idea is to bring the two, the religious and the scientific, together so that we can talk amicably and discuss respectfully our different points of view and understand how the two are both different and the same, and that we're not being disrespectful either to a scientist or to a religious person when we support one or the other.
Sure. Well, let me ask Rabbi Brody to weigh in on that question right there. Go ahead, Rabbi.
Well, one of the things that we managed to discuss both before the exhibit came to Ithaca and in the specifically clergy-oriented session is the fact that we are coming together from many different faith traditions, which have a number of different ways both of understanding our own stories and beliefs about creation, as well as understanding evolution and understanding what this exhibit itself has to show. one of the things that struck so many of us when we were touring the exhibit with Dr. Potts and members of the Smithsonian team was the way in which our fossil record can actually speak to us as humans and to our humanity. There happens to be for a fossil that is depicted on one of the portions of this exhibit where it is clear that the person, and this is a person who lived millions of years ago, had no teeth and was not in a physical shape to be moving around very much. And yet we are able to tell from the scientific record that this person lived for years in this condition, indicating that this was an individual who was cared for by other members of the community. And being able to take a look at this scientific record that actually shows some of the values that so many of our faith traditions hold about empathy and caring for others. So there are ways that we are interacting with this exhibit on that level. Another thing that the Smithsonian team did particularly well, I think, and that they did very nicely in some of their training sessions and is up on the website that documents some extra pieces of this exhibit and of the, not just the traveling exhibit, but the permanent exhibit that they have in the Smithsonian, where it talks about the fact that there are multiple ways in which one might view the interaction between science and religion. And there are a number of different quotes from a variety of leaders and organizations representing a wide array of religions, and they're not a unanimous voice. We are not a unanimous voice, even within my own faith tradition of the Jewish tradition. We are not unanimous in our beliefs about whether science and religion at particular instances come into conflict or whether they are teaching us completely separate pieces about the world around us or whether they interact with one another. And I think that there are a number of wonderful ways of exploring all of these questions that are being done in conjunction with this exhibit.
Sure. And Rabbi, I don't bring this up to be sort of trite or dismissive, but I wonder if you agree that as science and religion sort of work to reconcile either some differences or at least understand that there may be a coexistence that is complementary. One of the differences that I think a lot of people would probably argue, and this is why we see science and religion at loggerheads sometimes, is that faith is the definition of faith is believing without evidence, or at least that's packed into the definition, believing without evidence, where science champions evidence and rigorous examination. And it doesn't mean you have to believe two contradictory things, but I think people from the scientific community might be inclined to say, we can talk about this if at the very least we can have a baseline of agreement on certain scientific, I don't know if you want to use the word facts or scientific understanding of evolution, of certain things that are, as we know them, to be true. Do you disagree with that?
I actually think this is one of the big misconceptions when it comes to trying to discuss science and religion, especially because many religions are being grouped together in this case, and our different faith traditions treat our biblical stories, treat our different texts that we have in very different ways. Within the Jewish tradition, we actually have a multiplicity of voices and a multiplicity of understandings of the biblical text and as it's been handed down to us through our rabbinic tradition. And we actually believe that the creation stories that are in the Torah, in the five books of Moses, are incomplete, and we have rabbinic traditions that actually say that we need to complete the work of creation. And this is used in a number of different ways, depending on which particular topic is being discussed. But one of those being that we have to continue to be doing things in this world, that the world was not simply created and left as is, but that we continue to work with the world around us. We have a tradition of midrash, of stories, of different ways of understanding. And we even see the biblical text itself in Genesis as having two different stories, which we then interpret in multiple ways from there. Some of my colleagues from other faith traditions view some of these same texts in a very different way and view certain things in a different literal reading as opposed to a more metaphoric reading. So I think that it's very problematic to lump together all of religion as having any singular view, because our different faith traditions really do view our foundational texts very differently.
Okay, sure. Absolutely. Dr. Warren Ullman, director of the Paleontological Research Institution, the PRI in Ithaca, and he's a professor of paleontology in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. You heard a lot from the other two guests, Dr. Ullman. I'll open it up to you to take it however you want there. Go ahead, sir.
Well, first of all, I just want to thank Sally Grubb for all the hard work that she's done to make this exhibit happen. She and I started talking about this, I guess it was 2 years ago. And as she mentioned, one of the wonderful things about Ithaca is that we're kind of overqualified to do a lot of things. And it turned out that one of those was to talk about human evolution. The traveling exhibit that is now at the Tompkins County Library is based on a permanent exhibit which opened maybe 6 years ago, the Hall of Human Origins at the National Museum of Natural History in Washington. And a big part of that exhibit hall in Washington is 15 or so sculptures. And those sculptures were done representing different kinds of ancient hominids. And those sculptures were done by a fabulous paleo artist named John Gerchy, who just happens to live here in Trumansburg. And he's the artist in residence here at PRI. And that may not be a household name, but most people would recognize his work. He tends to be the person that National Geographic calls every time there's a new hominid to reconstruct. And so we were able to kind of tap some local talent. And he gave a wonderful talk on this last Saturday. And as Sally said, there are all these amazing talks from faculty, from area colleges, and so there's a really rich, rich, rich offering. And that's just this month. Then next month, as Sally mentioned, we will have a second exhibit that was put together by our staff here at PRI and faculty and staff at Cornell in the Department of Anthropology. And that will be a really kind of a second helping of this. You'll get to see a lot more skeletal cast material and a lot more exploration of some themes of human evolution. And then that will continue through February. We've been celebrating Darwin Days in Ithaca since 2006. And so this will be... this year we will be focusing on human evolution. So the week of Darwin's birthday is the 12th of February. So starting the 12th through the 17th, we'll have a whole week of activities, mostly focused on human evolution, not entirely. And again, that makes use of mostly local talent, but Ian Tattersall, who's a very famous paleoanthropologist at the American Museum of Natural History in New York, will be our keynote speaker that week. So if you've never been to Washington, never seen the Hall of Human Origins, if you are just interested in kind of getting some really world-class programming and exhibits between now and the end of February, this is an amazing opportunity for folks in the region to do that.
Back in July, when I read the article that I opened with in the introduction, evolution is happening faster than we thought. Of course, the article looks at you know, everything from the blackbird to spiders, and spiders in Vienna that are evolving to build their webs near moth-attracting streetlights. And in some cities, moths are developing a resistance to the lure of light bulbs. I mean, just really remarkable when you think about this. And I'm curious to know, Dr. Ullman, how you think, you know, what's the human parallel to that? How are we evolving in ways that we might not immediately look at and say that's evolution? And it might be culturally and it might be scientifically, but how are we evolving in ways that kind of mirror that, that we are maybe not appreciating fully?
Well, that article that you mentioned in the New York Times is just a fantastic article. I cut it out myself and have read it to my classes several times. It really highlights kind of a swath of research that's been going on, I don't know, for several decades, that focuses on how humans have changed the evolution of other species. And as you mentioned, you can see this happening in your backyards all the time. You can see, you can also see it every time you go to the pharmacy and somebody says, get your flu shot. The reason we have to get a flu shot every year is because the flu virus evolves. The reason that we have to worry about every new disease that pops up is because diseases evolve. And in fact, there's an entire field called evolutionary medicine now. And so I suppose the most immediate answer to your question about kind of evolution mattering in our day-to-day lives, and particularly with regard to humans, is our health on a regular basis is governed by the process of evolution, either the evolutionary process affecting us, our bodies, or the evolutionary process affecting the things that are attacking our bodies. We are constantly subjected to pathogens, germs and bacteria, viruses, and parasites that are evolving, and evolving in response to our bodies, evolving in response to the chemicals that we throw at them. And in the last, say, quarter century, medicine has finally come around to that point of view, and now evolutionary medicine is actually a real subfield. It's taught in a number of medical schools, including Cornell in New York City. And so I suppose that's the first answer. Every time you go to the pharmacy and look at a sign that says get a flu shot, you should be thinking about evolution. Our bodies are, we like to think of ourselves as separate from nature, but we're not. And humans do evolve. Now, we evolve in different ways than we have before. The most obvious, maybe one of the most obvious, is that infant mortality in most of the world, particularly in developed nations, is a tiny fraction of what it was just a century ago. And that absolutely has some implications for human evolution. We live longer. That has implications for human evolution. So now, but as you say, cultural evolution, which is different than the evolution of our physical bodies, cultural evolution long ago overtook physical evolution in terms of rapidity and significance. We change culturally practically every day, whereas physically we change much more slowly. But we absolutely are constantly changing as populations shift, and that will never change because we live in an environment, a highly modified environment, most of us, but we live in an environment. So every time you look in the mirror, you're actually looking at the results of evolution.
Let me get one quick listener coming in. Alan writes to me and just says, Evan, no offense to your panelists, but it sounds like everyone is tap dancing around a certain issue, which is that when it comes to religion, too often I hear that the earth is still 6,000 years old. It is not. We need to be able to say that it is not, and that evolution as we understand it scientifically is real. If we can start there, then yes, I agree that maybe we can get along. And I'm not saying that all people of faith believe that. In fact, I understand it, that most people do not. But Alan is saying he's bothered by this, that this notion that we still have to deal with, you know, a number of people, probably in this country and beyond, saying that the earth is 6,000 years old, and we know it is not. And Pew Research finds only 6 in 10 adults, well, 62%, say that humans have evolved over time. 25% of adults say evolution was guided by a supreme being, and I understand that. So anyway, the bottom line is I'm reading Alan's email. I'm looking at this Pew Research. And let me just start with Dr. Ullman, and we'll go around the panel here. What would you say, Dr. Ullman, to Alan about his feelings about are we tap dancing around too politely about religion and 6,000 years old? And I'm also curious how you feel about this. 62% of adults say humans have evolved over time. That seems like a failure of education.
So let's see. So where should we start? So the Pew data that you just mentioned is slightly different in its spin from the Gallup poll data, okay, which people might be familiar with. It's all about how you ask the question to some degree. If you ask, have humans evolved, you get one answer. If you ask, have humans descended from simpler organisms, in other words, is God involved? It all depends on how you phrase things. But it is true that about half of Americans, when you kind of generalize across all the polls, about half of Americans accept evolution in some way, just shape or form, and that means about half of Americans don't. And that is the lowest, by far, the lowest acceptance rate in the developed world, except for Turkey. And that's a source of all kinds of complaining by scientists and philosophers. But it is what it is. Now, within that, let's just call it non-acceptance of evolution, as Rabbi Brody just beautifully described, there is an enormous amount of diversity. There are people who identify themselves as creationists who do, in fact, believe that the Earth is 6,000 to 10,000 years old, and they mean that absolutely in every detail. They mean that every word of the King James Bible is true as written in English, and that is a very strong and kind of obvious thing for people to talk about. But that is not the majority of Americans by any means. There is an enormous spectrum, even within Protestantism, of what might be called creationist or non-evolutionist points of view. And then in Catholicism has historically had much less trouble with evolution in the last 150 years than Protestantism. But there are two popes ago, John Paul had no problem with most of evolution. His successor had a lot of problem with evolution. Pope Francis doesn't seem to have any problem with evolution. And then, as Rabbi Brody said, if you go into the Jewish tradition or the Islamic tradition, there are also a huge spectrum of views. So, yes, it's true. About half of Americans don't accept evolution, and that is a failure of education, as you say. But within that is an enormous diversity, and this is America, right? So there's an enormous diversity in just about everything, but there's enormous diversity, and what I like about this Smithsonian exhibit is that it really tries to address that diversity and learn from it and not celebrate it. That's a kind of a lame word in this context, but to take account of it and recognize it and try to include it in the discussion. I totally agree with the listener who commented that, yes, there are certain religious views that cannot be accommodated with science. Absolutely, that is true.
Okay.
But not all religious views are that way.
Yeah, and I think, as Rabbi Brody pointed out, we would be in dangerous territory if we just said science versus religion. But Rabbi Brody, you want to follow up with a little bit to what Alan, our listener, emailed?
Sure. I would say that I'll actually, there is a group, Sinai and Synapses, that was working in conjunction with the AAAS, the Scientific Society, specifically looking at beliefs regarding science and religion. And they found that views, particularly in terms of where people saw conflict, and a lot of where that conflict centers is on this question of creation and evolution and what is our origin, that a lot of that really was correlated very strongly with particular religion and particular branch within a religion. So that's the first piece that, that I would say that I think that it was already said so nicely. I would also like to add this question of failure of education as an educator. Whenever I hear a term like that, I have to wonder what the education purpose is, you know, that I whether we are talking that there are people who don't understand what the theory of evolution is, despite teachers trying to teach what the theory of evolution is, versus people who adopt, who learn the theory and then come to believe that that represents either a truth or the truth about the world around them. And I do think that we often need to make that distinction because there are so many people, and we, you know, I am coming from the Jewish tradition, which has a particular set of beliefs and stories and traditions regarding where we came from, which I think is a different question than what it means to be human, but what the origin of humanity is. And that is a very different set of beliefs than the Native American beliefs from the variety of different Native American groups who have their own understandings of the origins of humans, which again is very different from Chinese beliefs about the origins of people, of humans. So I do think that we need to make some of these distinctions when we are having these conversations. And yes, I am sure that there are teachers and schools that fail to adequately teach what the theory of evolution is. And I am also sure that there are people who are unconvinced of the validity of that theory. But as someone who also has a PhD in neuroscience, I am very well aware that anytime we have a scientific theory, it is called a theory for a reason. And there are those who believe it and those who don't believe it and therefore seek to disprove it. Evolution is something for which we have a lot of evidence, but our understanding of the process of evolution and what the theory of evolution encompasses has changed over time and continues to change. The story that you pointed out about the blackbird is a very new understanding of the amount of time that it takes for evolution to occur.
Are you saying our understanding is evolving?
One might say that, yes.
Okay. that's kind of where I thought you were going. I'm significantly late for a break, and Andrew and Aronica, we're going to come to you. We're hearing from some listeners. Mary in Rochester called in to say it, and maybe Megan Mack, producer, can help me understand if this story is true or if this comedian is making a joke. She said there's a Kathleen Madigan's a comedian who tells a story about a school in Louisiana that teaches kids the Loch Ness Monster is real, and because the monster is real, evolution cannot be. But I don't think that can. Megan Mack will fact check that for me. Before we go to break, I want Sally Grubb, if we could, the exhibit coordinator for the Tompkins County Public Library, to remind our listeners why we are talking about evolution. What's the quick snapshot for example, what's coming up on Thursday and then what people can do through the 22nd, 23rd, Sally?
Immediately they can come on Thursday to the talk that you mentioned, From Human Origins to Human Opportunities, Science, Religion, and Culture as Essential Decision-Making Tools for Turbulent Times. And this is being run by Eric Clay of Shared Journeys, an organization in Ithaca. And Eric is a really good leader of group conversation and people coming from different perspectives. So this is going to be a really very worthwhile talk. Then on Saturday, December the 10th, we have two programs. The first one in the morning, and these are both at the public library, how does Neanderthal DNA impact our human biology today? This is presented by Aaron Sams, who's a PhD and biological anthropologist and computational biologist at Cornell University. Then in the afternoon, a program that I am really looking forward to is being presented by Frederick Gleach, who's an historical anthropologist and senior lecturer and curator of the anthropological collections at Cornell. And he is talking on about tools and human development, thinking about people through the things they make. And he has tools that go back hundreds of thousands of years to when man just picked up a stone to break a nut or to knock the head off, to knock out an animal he wanted to eat, right up to modern day tools. So that's going to be very, very interesting. And if you want a quick snapshot, we're calling this Ithaca Explores Human Origins, 3 months of exploring what it means to be human, which includes the exhibit we have at the moment. You Are Here, Exploring Human Evolution, and then Darwin Days. And this continues through the end of February 2017.
Well, and is it all collected online for people to check out, Sally?
Yes. You can go to tcpl.org, and in the right-hand corner of the home page, there's a link to all the information about the exhibit, about the programs, and that is constantly updated when new things are included in the programming.
And my word, it is true. Megan Mack sends me a note that, yes, there is a school. The Accelerated Accelerated Christian Education publishes textbooks for some private Christian schools in Louisiana, and they were teaching that Scotland's Loch Ness Monster is real, and a claim that is held as evidence disproving Charles Darwin's theory of evolution. I don't mean to laugh. Again, we're trying to be respectful, but that's something we have to say is not right. So let's...
So when we come back,
yes.
I would like to talk about the program that we had yesterday afternoon.
Sure. Let's do that.
If we may.
So let's do this. So let's get our only break of the hour. We'll come back. We'll talk about that program. Andrew, hang in there. We'll get your phone call in as well. Got a question from Gary on some differences when it comes to certain terminology that may help us when we talk about evolution. So a lot to discuss with Sally Grubb from the Tompkins County Public Library, Rabbi Suzanne Brody, who's the Director of Education at Temple Beth El Ithaca, and Dr. Warren Ullman, who's the Director of the Paleontological Research Institution. That's the PRI in Ithaca, and he's also a professor of paleontology in the Department of Earth and Atmospheric Sciences at Cornell University. We continue in a moment. I'm Evan Dawson, Tuesday on The Next Connections. You might have heard last week we had County Executive of Monroe County, Cheryl Donolfo, on the program for an hour. We're giving Democrats in the legislature a chance to respond. So you'll hear from Cindy Kaley, leader of the Democrats in the legislature, and some others. And we will talk about their response to issues related to the budget and much more. We're talking county business Tuesday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Sally Grubb, tell us about yesterday. What happened?
Well, yesterday we had a program presented by Professor Ross Brann, who's the Milton Konvitz Professor of Judeo-Islamic Studies and Stephen H. Weiss Presidential Fellow at Cornell University. And he teaches about comparative religion and politics. And his talk was Embracing Science as a Sacred Obligation, What We Can Learn from Abba Rose and Maimonides, Two 12th century religious intellectuals. Abba Rose is a Muslim, and Maimonides was a Jew. And he talked about the intellectual obligation of these two religious leaders to learn more as part of their faith, and that their faith required them to learn as much as possible about science as they possibly could, and for their faith to be informed by that science, and that if the two were in conflict, that they should go back to their faith tradition to see where that needed to be viewed differently. And I'm hope I'm not misrepresenting Professor Brann at all, that much of what is presented in the stories in religions is allegory as opposed to the data and the facts that come through from science. And it was a fascinating presentation. The questions went on for half an hour after his talk. He's going to send me the PowerPoint of his talk, and I hope to be able to put that up online to give people a flavor of how he presented it. And it was fascinating. The importance for everybody to understand that none of us know everything. We know an enormous amount about evolution, but we don't know it all yet. And our faiths give us a different human, spiritual, faith-based perspective on all of that and help make the picture whole. And the more that I have been involved in this and the more programs I've been to and the more I've learned, the more empowered I am to accept both sides of the conversation, the religious, and hearing Rabbi Brody talk and talking with her as we drove to Geneva, and then listening to people like Professor Allman and the Smithsonian people. There is so much to know that in some sense we can all be right as long as we come together and accept that the picture is very, very big.
Let me get Andrew in Irondequoit, who's been waiting to join the conversation. Go ahead, Andrew.
Great show, Evan. Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
My take is, well, from what I've studied in Genesis, is the first verse, in between the first verse and the second verse, you can have any amount of time you want. So in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and then the word was in the King James shouldn't be there. It should be the word became, and the earth became dark and void. And then the 6 days of God remaking the earth is recorded in those first in that first chapter of Genesis. Do you understand where I'm going with this?
Yep.
You can have your dinosaurs and all your evolution and all that stuff, and then it becomes dark and void. Tohuva bohu, I think, is the Hebrew, and then the record in Genesis is God remaking the earth that had become dark and void, and which is why all the dinosaurs died, because something shut the lights out.
Okay, Rabbi Brody, you want to hit that one?
So there are a lot of different interpretations of what is happening in the first two chapters of Genesis, and certainly there are a number of people who have discussed what the time frame of any of it is. The phrase tohu vavohu, the unformed and void, is a very interesting phrase. And the idea of having 6 days of creation within the Jewish tradition, there are a lot of ways of thinking about that and certainly questions as to, at the time that all of these things are forming, what is the length of a day when you are just having the beginning of the formation of the heavens and of the earth itself? What is a day when we are just starting to form this planet? And the questions only become more complicated once we reach the point of having other living things that are here and people and the fact that the first chapter of Genesis describes the creation of people differently than the second chapter of Genesis does leads to a lot of different interpretations within Judaism, at least, about how humans came to be here on this earth. And even within the exhibit from the Smithsonian, we see on one of the interactive panels that there are three different ways of grouping the various fossil records we have into three different understandings of how that evolution occurred.
All right, let me get a few more listener comments. Dave writes to us and says, every time an antibiotic fails against a class of bacteria, evolution has happened. Thank you, Dave. And Gary writes to us with a question, and I will kick this question over to Dr. Ullman. Gary says, speaking of distinctions, it may help if your panel could explain the difference between evolution and natural selection, and also what a theory is and isn't. Dr. Ullman?
Excellent questions. Evolution is the word that we are all familiar with, but it is really worth remembering that Darwin didn't actually use the word evolution, at least in the first edition of his book, Origin of Species. He used the word evolved as the very last word of the very first edition of The Origin. Then other authors came along and used the word evolution, and so Darwin picked it up in later editions. The reason that's important because Darwin had a better term for it. Darwin used the term descent with modification, and that's a much more descriptive word for what we are sitting here talking about as evolution. Descent with modification means that organisms have a pattern of common ancestry. That means you are not descended from your cousin. You have a common ancestor with your cousin. And change happens generation to generation. That's what descent with modification means. And that's pretty much what we mean by evolution, that organisms share patterns of common ancestry and have changed through time. Now, full stop, why does that phenomenon occur? And there are lots and lots of possible mechanisms. We could sit here and make up lots of mechanisms. If we all agreed that descent with modification or evolution occurs, we still wouldn't know why it occurs. And the second thing Darwin did, besides convince everybody that descent with modification occurs, is he proposed a particular mechanism, and that's called natural selection. And natural selection is a pretty simple idea. It says that too many organisms are born that can survive. Many more are born than can survive to reproduce themselves. And up until recently, that was true even of human beings. But the vast majority of every organism you can think of, from flies to deer to everything else, produces many more babies than will grow up to reproduce. The second thing is they have differences that help them survive and reproduce, and some of those differences are inherited. And if all that's true, then it will take place that those organisms that do survive and reproduce a little bit better contribute more of their genes to subsequent generations, and that's natural selection. So the reason this is so important is because a lot of people, as we were talking about earlier, can accept evolution, but they really don't like natural selection. And this is an important point because a vast majority of biologists today, almost every biologist who knows anything about whole organisms, accepts evolution by natural selection. But natural selection is actually a kind of a difficult idea for people to accept. It's not difficult intellectually. It's really simple intellectually. But it's actually a little bit uncomfortable for some people. It says that there is no plan, there is no goal, there is no supernatural power looking over the shoulder of all these organisms, making sure they're okay. There is a great deal of pain and wastage and suffering in the world. Darwin made a big deal of that, and it impressed him a great deal, troubled him a great deal. And natural selection says that all of that takes place only because of organisms struggling to survive and reproduce. And let's face it, that's a kind of an uncomfortable notion. And so a lot of the difficulty that people have with what we're sitting here talking about is evolution actually has to do with evolution by natural selection. Now, there are a bunch of people who don't like being related to non-human organisms, but a lot of people don't like Darwinian evolution because it includes natural selection. And the only way to say this is that there is an overwhelming amount of evidence for both descent with modification, and natural selection. As has been said several times, that doesn't make them true. It just means that there's an overwhelming amount of evidence at the current time for them. And if you look at the evidence, not accepting those, it is thought by virtually every biologist in the world to be nonsensical. Again, that doesn't make it true, but and that's where if you want to make everybody happy and that everybody can live together and we can all get along and believe anything you want, that's where it does begin to get a little difficult. If you look for commonalities, there are plenty of commonalities, and we've just been talking about a bunch of them for the last hour, but there are real differences. And some of, as you get more and more into this topic, you, not surprisingly, you locate those differences, as well as some of the commonalities.
And Dr. Ullman, I've got to jump in.
What's a theory? What's a theory? A theory is
20 seconds.
You've
got to do it in 20 seconds.
We come up with theories. Theories are ideas, hypotheses. Hypotheses are just theories are well-supported hypotheses. A theory is not a guess.
That is the important thing. We use theory as a wild guess, as sort of a euphemism for wild guess too often, and that is another failure in the American language uses. Look, I have failed remarkably miserably when it comes to getting through all the things I wanted to talk about this hour, which is just an indication that listeners, if you're interested in subjects like evolution and what it means to be human, well, you've got between now and December 22nd to get to the Tompkins County Public Library for that. Look them up online. There's a lot more going on because they're exploring what it means to be human in this 3-month exploration down there. So there's so much going on, and I just want to thank Sally Grubb for calling it to our attention, the exhibit coordinator for the Tompkins County Public Library. Thank you so much, Sally.
You're very welcome.
And Rabbi Suzanne Brody from Temple Beth El Ithaca as well. Our great pleasure. Thank you so much, Rabbi.
Thank you for having me.
Dr. Ullman, wish I had you in class. Thanks for taking the time for us, sir.
Glad to be here. Thanks a lot.
And again, jump online, enjoy that exhibit. Our thanks to our friends from WEOS as well. Have a great afternoon.